The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating over 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
On August 4, 2008, Dr. Charles Armstrong, director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University, presented a two-part overview of Korean history at the Korea Society in New York. In this second lecture, Dr. Armstrong discusses modern Korean history, beginning in 1876 with Korea's first formal diplomatic treaty with Japan.
Okay, why don't we get started? For the second half, I want to be much more informal, and it will be accompanied by images. Since we are in the modern period, we have photographs, and also some other types of images as well. In 1876, Korea established its first formal diplomatic treaty, and that was with Japan. The second country with which Korea established formal diplomatic relations with the United States in 1882. And that followed by Britain, France, Russia. China itself established a very different relationship with Korea through a modern Western-style diplomatic treaty. The Western-centric global system of international relations was very different from what Korea had dealt with in the past. In some ways, it was exactly the opposite. If Korea's relationship to China in this China-centered world order was one in which theoretically Korea was subordinate, but in reality Korea was independent, its relationship with Japan became the opposite. In theory, they were equals, but in reality, Japan had the upper hand. Korea attempted its own type of modernization by the early 1880s. The Korean court and the Korean elite realized that they could not continue in the old ways that they had done before. And in 1881, the Korean king sent an observer mission to Japan to see what the Japanese were doing, and also to China, which itself was trying to modernize along Western lines, and thence to Europe and to the United States. But there was a great deal of ambivalence. Korea, like China, was not able to gather up the will to completely reform as Japan had done. The Meiji Restoration, as it was called, of 1868, was really more of a revolution in the sense that much of traditional Japan was totally overturned in the 1870s and 1880s. But China and Korea were, it seems, too wedded to their old ways to be able to go too far down that path. In 1884, a small group of educated Korean men decided to take matters into their own hands. They had been educated to some extent in Japan, and with the support of the Japanese government, attempted a coup d'etat, kidnapped some of the top officials of the Korean court, and tried to establish a modernizing regime. This lasted all of 3 days, and all of the conspirators were arrested, and most of them fled back to Japan, where they were under the protection of Japan. And this, therefore, over the next 20 years, you had this tension that the Koreans simply were not able to resolve for problems of their own and also because of pressures from the outside. And that tension was that the people who really wanted to modernize Korea were associated with foreign governments and foreign desires, especially of the Japanese. Whereas the people who consider themselves or were more considered loyal and patriotic were against modernization. That had some very unfortunate consequences for Korea at the end of the 19th century. In the early 1890s, there was another problem that emerged within Korea, and that was a rise of a new religion called Tonghak, T-O-N-G-H-A-K, in the old romanization. The Tonghak religion was a new religion that emerged in the early 1860s under a very charismatic founder and leader named Che, who gathered up a large following of disaffected and many times poor people in the southern part of the country. The founder of Tonghak was executed in 1864 for treason, and the religion went underground. It reemerged in the early 1890s as its followers under the second leader tried to petition the Korean king to exonerate their founder and to legalize the religion. Christianity also had an important role to play in the second half of the 19th century, and Christianity was seen with some ambivalence, indeed often hostility, by the Korean court. Not so much because of the religion itself, although there were some aspects of the Christian religion which the Korean elite found very disturbing. In particular, Christianity advocated equality and threatened the social foundations of hierarchy within Korea. And this was a problem that Christianity encountered in China as well, the Catholic Church forbade ancestor veneration, ancestor worship. And this was considered the very foundation of the Confucian social order, the veneration of your ancestors. This was a papal edict declared that to be idolatry. Devout Catholics were not supposed to venerate their ancestors in the early 19th century. Several Korean scholars were executed for destroying their ancestral tablets and not carrying out ancestral rites. As time progressed, Christianity also became associated with Western imperialism. This became a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy as the Western powers, particularly France, reacted very strongly to the persecution of Christianity within Korea. And in 1866, the French Navy sent a ship to the coast of Korea and had a skirmish with the Koreans. In part, the Navy went there to defend French Catholic missionaries and their Korean converts. The French were defeated, but Christianity was allowed a bit more freedom from that point on. The same year, a little bit later, an American ship called the General Sherman sailed into the north of the country toward the city of Pyongyang, which was the second largest city in Korea, now, of course, the capital of North Korea. The Korean coastal defenses demanded that they turn away. The purpose of the Sherman's visit was to ask the Koreans to have a trade relations with the United States. It was an American ship, but it was a largely foreign and mixed crew, including an English missionary. After the ship refused the orders to turn back, it ran aground and it was attacked by a group of Koreans and burned, and all of the crew was killed. It's said that years later you could still go to Pyongyang and see the anchor of the SS Sherman on the city wall as a kind of warning to foreigners who tried to enter Korea without permission. If you go to Pyongyang today, the General Sherman is painted in a huge mural along the side of the Museum of Korean History. And there's a monument where the Sherman ran aground. Next to that monument is the USS Pueblo. What's the USS Pueblo? Yeah. Back there? Yes. That's right. In January 1968, the American surveillance ship was seized off the coast of North Korea. And its crew held captive for almost a year, or 11 months. Created quite a diplomatic row between North Korea and the United States. And for many years, the crew was released, but the ship remained anchored off the east coast of Korea, of North Korea. Then several years ago, just at a time when the U.S.-North Korean relations seemed to be improving, all of a sudden the North Koreans took the ship around the coast and up to the west coast of North Korea and docked it and made it a museum of American aggression next to the USS Sherman. So clearly, you know, it shows this continuity. Americans are not to be trusted. Something to think about as we seem to be in a period of, once again, improving relations between U.S. and North Korea. Anyway, and then with the difficulty of communication of the 1860s, it wasn't quite clear to the U.S. what happened to the Sherman. And in 1871, another American ship was sent to investigate the Sherman and also to ask for a shipwreck convention, to ask for Korea to sign on to a shipwreck convention. Should another ship, you know, disappear. And this time the American ship went to the southern part to Seoul, toward Seoul off Kangwa Island, and again the Koreans asked them not to enter, and there was a clash between the Korean coastal defenses and the American ship, the USS Monocracy, which the Americans won. Several hundred Koreans were killed, but then again, the Koreans did not sign a shipwreck treaty, and the Americans turned away. It was the largest naval engagement that the United States had between the end of the Civil War and the Spanish-American War, but it went almost completely unnoticed in the U.S. media, except for the New York Herald Tribune, which had a headline that read, "Our Little War with the Heathen." Incidentally, when I first visited North Korea in 1997, I was with a small Christian NGO group who were all from North Carolina, and we were shown the monument to the General Sherman. And our guide said, "I'm very embarrassed to be talking about this incident to a group of Americans." And my colleague from North Carolina said, "Oh, that's okay. I'm from the South, and we hate General Sherman, too." The Japanese economic penetration became deeper and deeper. Korea became overwhelmingly dependent on Japanese trade because it had not much contact economically with other parts of the world. In the 1880s, Japan moved very aggressively into Korea at that time. Getting back to Tongak, in the 1890s, Tongak reemerged, the Tongak religion, and the king refused the religious emissaries' demand to rehabilitate their founder, and the Tongak movement began to take on a different color, and that was the color of a peasant uprising, an attack on local authority in favor not just of religious freedom, but also of addressing the socioeconomic grievances of the peasant class. And this seems to have been related to the Japanese incursion in so much as part of the economic change of Korea at this time, in the 1880s and 1890s, was rise in prices, immiseration of peasant standard of living as goods flowed out of the country to Japan. In the summer of 1894, the Tongak movement was becoming a serious threat to the stability of Korea. The Tongak organizers had formed a kind of ad hoc army of mostly of farmers in the southwestern part of the country, which was the place where the greatest economic immiseration was taking place. By the fall of 1894, they were moving onto the capital, Seoul. And it is entirely conceivable that the Tongak army could have overthrown the Korean king and established their own government. But what the Korean king did in the time-honored tradition of Korean kings was to call on the Chinese for assistance. The Chinese agreed to send troops to defend the capital against the uprising, but this violated an agreement that the Japanese had established with the Chinese several years earlier, in which said that no foreign military force could be sent to Korea without the other's approval. So the Japanese sent their own army, which was much better armed and trained than the Chinese. The Tongak rebellion was put down, but then the Japanese and Chinese turned on each other, and the first Sino-Japanese war emerged in Korea. By 1895, the Japanese had defeated China, which was a tremendous shock not only to the Chinese but to the Koreans. Who, you may recall, still remembered and venerated the great defense of their territory against Japan in the late 16th century with Chinese assistance. with the defeat of China, the pro-Japanese forces within Korea could gain the upper hand. The exiles we talked about who left Korea at the failed coup of 1884 came back and established a reformist government in Korea in 1894. And this, among other things, was the time at which legislation was passed to outlaw slavery. The question was, when did slavery end? Well, it ended as part of this reform effort to modernize Korea after the defeat of China and the entrance of Japan. So there was a very dynamic effort at modernizing Korea in 1894, 1895, and a series of reform legislations. The irony was, however, that this was done in part through pressure of Japan and through the presence of Japanese troops on Korea, which did not leave after the Sino-Japanese War ended in 1895. So the Japanese presence in Korea then became permanent. Japan did not take over Korea in 1895, but they had advisors in Korea. Still, it was not by any means foreordained that Korea would become colonized by Japan. Still, in the late 1890s, the government of Korea existed as an independent government. It attempted to have some of its own modernizing reforms. And in 1897, in fact, the king of Korea declared himself emperor. There's a long, complicated story behind this. He went into hiding in the Russian legation after the murder of his wife, Queen Min, by Japanese people, Japanese military folks. But 1897 was really the last attempt at a kind of indigenous reform by Koreans. And the reason that the king declared himself emperor in 1897 was to put Korea on the same level of China and Japan. Japan had an emperor, China had an emperor, now Korea had an emperor. And as we said earlier, in traditional times, the only emperor that Korea recognized was in China. But now it was no longer a world centered on China, but a world of equals in East Asia. Still, Korea's future looked precarious. The government was unstable, the economic situation was far from certain. And furthermore, Korea was getting more pressure from the outside, not only from China and Japan now, but a new significant player on the scene, and that was Russia. The Russian Empire had reached the Pacific in the 1860s. Russian merchants, Russian Orthodox missionaries, and others were entering the Korean Peninsula from the north. And with the weakening of China after the Sino-Japanese War, Russia and Japan now became rivals for influence in Northeast Asia. This was a great time of geopolitics, of the so-called Great Game between Russia and Britain all across the Eurasian landmass from Iran and Afghanistan to the coast of China. And Japan increasingly saw Russia as a threat, and in particular, the Russian presence in Korea and in Manchuria as a threat. In 1896, Japan and Russia had a secret set of negotiations in St. Petersburg, the capital of Russia at the time. And one of the suggestions that the Japanese and Russia, the Japanese presented to the Russians was to divide Korea into spheres of influence, to have the Russian influence in the north and Japanese influence in the south. But that did not work out. They did not reach an agreement on that, and that was shelved. That might sound familiar because, of course, that's basically what the Soviet Union and the United States did agree on in 1945, although the Americans who negotiated this said they had no idea that the Japanese and the Russians had discussed the same thing 50 years earlier. As Russia and Japan became increasingly tense in their relations in Northeast Asia, Russia established a naval outpost off the Liaodong Peninsula in China, which it called Port Arthur, which Japan saw as a very serious threat to their security in the region. And in February 1904, Japanese airplanes launched a surprise attack on the Russian naval base and wiped out the Russian naval forces in Port Arthur. That may also sound familiar, and this is why I think Americans should know more about history. There's a great quote in a book of Japanese history by one of the pilots at Pearl Harbor, and he said, as I flew over and looked at all of the American ships docked next to each other, I thought, how could the Americans do this? Do they realize how vulnerable they are? Had they never heard of Port Arthur? And, of course, Americans hadn't heard of Port Arthur. Otherwise, they would not have made themselves sitting ducks for Japanese bombers exactly the way that the Russians had done in 1904. Russia was also defeated by Japan. And if China's defeat by Japan 10 years earlier was a shock, Russia's defeat was an even bigger shock. It was the first European imperial power to be defeated by an Asian country, probably in the last 500 years. It led to the dissolution of the Russian government in the first Russian Revolution of 1905, which then led in turn to the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. And for Korea, it meant the formal domination of Japan over Korean affairs. The Russo-Japanese War peace treaty was negotiated in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, by Theodore Roosevelt, whose efforts he received the Nobel Peace Prize. The Treaty of Portsmouth gave basically Japan carte blanche to run Korea without actually giving Korea formally to Japan as a territory. Japan would have advisors at every level of the Korean government. Japan would control Korea's foreign affairs. Korea would become a protectorate in the language of the times, not a colony, but something a little bit lower in status than that, a protectorate of Japan. Koreans didn't necessarily agree with this. This was not a system that the Koreans had any voice in whatsoever. The Koreans were not consulted on this. On this protectorate treaty. And in 1907, as a precautionary measure, the Korean army was dissolved by the Japanese protectorate government. And sometimes when you occupy a country and get rid of the army, you can have problems. And so what you had in Korea in 1907, just as you had in Iraq in 2003, was a whole bunch of young men trained in the military with access to guns and no jobs. So this was the beginning of a kind of insurgency in modern times against, in modern parlance, against the Japanese, that went on for about 5 years. Thousands of Koreans were executed as part of this insurgency, so of a so-called Uibyeong, or righteous army. In 1909, the great Japanese statesman Ito Hirobumi, one of the leaders of the Meiji Restoration, head of the protectorate, resident general, as he was called, that was his title in Korea, was assassinated by a Korean in Manchuria at the Harbin Railway Station. So Korea was becoming a real problem. The Japanese were having a great deal of difficulty keeping Korea stable and keeping Koreans under control. And so they decided then having a protectorate wasn't enough, and the next step would be to formally annex Korea as a colony. So in August of 1910, Japan negotiated a amalgamation treaty, as it was called, merging Korea and Japan into one. It was not exactly a popular move on the part of most Koreans, and there is to this day a dispute over how voluntary this was on the part of the Korean emperor, and whether in fact his seal was put on the treaty voluntarily or whether it was stolen or forced and so forth. But regardless, the treaty was put into place and the independence of Korea was over. The Korean king, no longer an emperor. The Korean king still existed, but he was no longer the ruler of Korea. Rather, the ruler of Korea was a Japanese governor general. This began, and now we finally get to our first image, the Japanese occupation of Korea, or Japanese colonization of Korea. This was a time of the maximum global presence of colonies. The most important colonial powers were, of course, Britain and France, but also the Netherlands, Belgium, many other European countries had colonies overseas. And the United States, too, had its own major overseas colonies, a colony in Asia, and that was the Philippines. In fact, there is a certain connection between the Philippines and Korea through Japan and the United States, which is that in 1905, concerned about Japanese expansion in Asia, the Americans negotiated a secret agreement with Japan, which essentially recognized each other's sphere of influence. That is to say, the Japanese and Americans said that, or the Americans said to the Japanese, we'll leave you alone in Korea if you leave us alone in the Philippines. So, and the consensus in this country was that the Koreans needed foreign occupation. They were a backward people who needed to be uplifted through by a more modern power, and Japan happened to be in the neighborhood and had shown how successful its modernization project could be. So there wasn't much opposition in the United States, the Japanese takeover of Korea in 1910. There was, as I said, an insurgency. There's a very famous photo of the Japanese officers executing righteous army or Uibyeong insurgents. This term Uibyeong actually goes back to the 1590s and kind of spontaneous resistance against the first Japanese invasion at that time. But by 1912, it was pretty much wiped out. Korea was pacified as far as the Japanese could see. And what resistance there was largely went outside of the country. Japanese occupation of Korea is to some extent a controversial event. It's not really that controversial in Korea because most people hate it. But some people would say that it wasn't all bad, or at least it had some unintended positive effects for Korea. But Korea was in some ways modernizing before the Japanese came. It wasn't as if Korea was a place that time forgot. What the Japanese occupation did, however, was shape and accelerate the modernization of Korea in ways that it might not have done otherwise. But there were many symbolic as well as actual ways in which the Japanese occupation effaced or erased the Korean control over their own country. This is the Royal Palace of Korea. You see the mountain behind it. And in the 1920s, the Japanese colonial government decided to build a new imposing structure south, that is to say, in front of the Royal Palace, precisely because that would block the view of the palace by ordinary people in Korea. And that's looking from the other side, that's what it looked like, this domed neo-classical structure, very imposing, really enormously heavy, that dwarfed the traditional tile roof palace gate behind it. This also was not done only to block the view, but also the Japanese occupiers were aware of traditional Korean geomantic beliefs, and the belief was that the ruler needed to have a clear line for the energy from him to reach the people. With this blocked, the ruler's power was also eliminated. In addition to that, if you look at it from the air, this rectangular building with a line in the middle is the first character in the word for Japan, sun, nichi. So in both symbolic and in concrete ways, in this case literally concrete, Japan made its presence known as an occupying force. Japan also established its own residencies, the Chungmuro Honmachi, as the Japanese call it, District of Seoul. The Japanese settlers, at the peak, there were close to 750,000, three quarters of a million Japanese on the Korean Peninsula out of a population of 9 or 10 million Koreans. But most of the Japanese were very much confined to Japanese areas, and the biggest one being here in Seoul. And you can see it looks like Japan. It could be any city in Japan. There wasn't a lot of mixing. The Japanese very much kept to themselves. The Japanese colonial government was overwhelmingly run by Japanese, which might not be surprising, except that in many cases of European colonialism, indigenous people, native people, were much more represented in the local government. But the Japanese colonial government was overwhelmingly run by Japanese who came from the home islands to reside there. And there were also Japanese businessmen and many other types of Japanese as well. But the largest group of Japanese residents in Korea by far were government officials and the military. The main Japanese military base was Yongsan, which is now the main U.S. military base in Seoul. There were many signs of modernity that became much more visible. The roads were built and paved. New ports were expanded, especially on the east coast of Korea, to ship goods to reach Japan. But there also were interesting cultural changes as well. Here's a picture of from Korea of what in the Japanese were called modan no boy and modan ugaru, or modern boy and modern girl, or mobo and moga for short, which was a bit of a scandal. You see how short the skirt is and long stockings, the hat, and so forth. These sort of dissolute, decadent, westernized, Europeanized young people, which was quite a new sight in Korea at that time. Also, new forms of cultural expression began to really take off at this time, new types of theater. The cinema was introduced, movie theaters introduced to Korea in 1903. There's some debate over exactly what year it was introduced, but the first unambiguous records we have of movie theaters in Korea is in 1903, promoted by British and Americans. Actually, the very first movies were promoted by the British American Tobacco Company, and instead of paying money, you paid with two empty packs of cigarettes. So it was a way of promoting cigarettes. But the cinema really took off under the Japanese occupation in the 1920s, and the first films were made in Korea at that time. Radio was also established at the time in 1927, was the first radio broadcast from a Korean radio station, Keijo Broadcasting System, or KBS. Changes of transportation, fashion, art, and so forth became widely diffused through Korea. You can see women taking the trolley, somewhat caricatured here with their arms reaching up. I think this is a nice picture which shows the regularity of the modernization of the workforce, of people going, and particularly women, young women and girls going to work, which was a very new thing in Korea, and the new factories that emerged in Seoul and also elsewhere in the country. Freedom, let me go back to that, of women in some ways, or the greater opportunities for women, which was something very new. So the Japanese colonialization of Korea was a mixed affair. There was certainly a great deal of oppression. You didn't want to be taken to Soreimon prison because you might never come out. It was at the beginning a rule mostly by the military, by soldiers in Korea, until 1919. At 1919, there was a massive protest involving hundreds of thousands of Koreans against Japanese occupation, which did not result in success. That is to say, Korea was not made independent, but in the 1920s, the Japanese colonial government did relax its rule to some extent to allow more cultural expression, to allow Koreans to engage in Korean language arts, pursuits, and so forth. But at the same time, the actual rule of Japan over Korea could not be questioned. That was the outer limit against which Koreans could express themselves. There were new newspapers in Korea. They were allowed to be published at this time. There were movements for economic production, the production of Korean goods. The first university was established in Korea in 1926, which had been something that Korean nationalists had pushed for a long time, a Korean university. Korea had no university before then. Unfortunately, when the Japanese built the university, they built it for the Japanese. There was a university in Korea, but it was almost entirely for Japanese students. It was easier for Koreans to go to Japan to study than to study in Korea. It seems, I think, very hard to understand now, but that's the way colonialism was. And the Japanese, in some ways, were not so different in Korea than the British were in Kenya or the French in Vietnam. But I think it was particularly difficult, at least in retrospect, for the Koreans to get their minds around being ruled by Japanese, since, after all, for so many centuries, they had seen Japan as being slightly less civilized than Korea, as the Japanese being a bit backward, and Korea being a place of higher culture. So if you want to look at analogies, perhaps Britain and India, or the Dutch in Indonesia, or the French in Senegal is not that close. A closer comparison from a European perspective might be the English in Ireland, which is actually, I think, a rather interesting comparison. I had a friend who was an Irish nun in South Korea, and she once said to me, I know exactly the way the Koreans feel about the Japanese, because that's the way I feel about the English. And also two countries with a very long and difficult history, one has dominated the other for much of that history. In any case, The 1920s were a period of relative relaxation in some aspects of colonial rule and an emergence of Korean culture within the parameters of Japanese political domination. However, in the 1930s, that changed. In 1931, Japan invaded Manchuria. And in 1932, bombed Shanghai. And some people would say that's the beginning of World War II, 7 years before the Germans invaded Poland. But by 1936, full-scale war had erupted again between Japan and China. As a result of a skirmish outside of Beijing, the so-called Marco Polo Bridge incident. So 1936 began the mobilization of Japan and its empire for war. The Japanese empire now included Taiwan, which had been taken from China in 1895 after the end of the Sino-Japanese War, southern Sakhalin Island, which had been taken from Russia after the Russo-Japanese War in 1905, and of course Korea, annexed in 1910. With full-scale war against China, Japan needed all of its resources of its empire to fight this war against this enormous adversary, economically backward perhaps, but with a huge population. Japan found itself bogged down in what often was a guerrilla war on the Chinese mainland, and the decision was made that the Korean colony would be central to this. The northeast of China also had been taken in 1932, but not a formal colony. It was a supposedly independent country called Manchukuo, or the country of the Manchus. Has anybody seen the film The Last Emperor? Okay, yeah, it's a good film. I was almost in that film, but that's a story I'll save for the Q&A. I spent a year in Changchun. I must have done something terrible in previous life to deserve that. Which is the city in northeast China where the capital of Manchukuo was located and Puyi had his palace. The palace that the Japanese military essentially built for the last emperor of China is now, interestingly and appropriately enough, a museum of Japanese war atrocities. Anyway, 1936, with the war against China taking off, the Japanese home government in Tokyo and the Japanese colonial government in Seoul, or Keijo, as the Japanese renamed the city of Seoul, established a new policy which they called Naisen Itai in Japanese, Japan-Korea, or the inner and Korea, one body. And this then began a third phase of the Japanese colonial experience in Korea. The first phase was one of direct military rule until 1919. The second phase was a somewhat more relaxed period of so-called cultural rule in the 1920s and early 1930s. And this is a period of militarization in the late 30s up until the end of World War II. And these basically are some of the principles. Utilize all material and human resources for the war effort. My mother-in-law, for example, remembers when she was in elementary school in Seoul, she spent much of her time taking the tinfoil gum wrappers off of the gum to give to the colonial government to make into weapons, to use the tin for the war. And furthermore, and this is one of the things that Koreans remember as the greatest affront of Japanese colonial experience, Koreans were to follow Japanese customs and language exclusively. They were supposed to only speak Korean in public, only Japanese in public. All education from elementary school onward would be exclusively in Japanese. And you were even supposed to wear Japanese clothes, eat Japanese food, and speak Japanese at home. And Koreans have called this cultural genocide, an attempt to wipe out, or as the Japanese call it, assimilate Koreans into Japanese culture. And in 1939, Koreans were invited to adopt Japanese names. They were given the honor, as the colonial government put it, to change their names to Japanese names. And this also was a very bitter legacy of the Japanese occupation. Korea is, of course, a country with a very long history of distinctive identity, and names in particular are, of course, extremely important in a patrilineal system such as Korea. And when you change your name, you cut yourself off from your history, from the history of your family. Needless to say, it wasn't exactly voluntary. You could refuse to do it, but you might end up with no food rations, no jobs, and even in jail. In the end, some 84%, according to the colonial records, complied with this name change ordinance and changed their names to Japanese names. And finally, hundreds of thousands were employed in Japanese factories and mines. Indeed, by the end of the Japanese colonial period, a couple of million Koreans were in Japan. And many of them went there to work in the most difficult jobs as the Japanese young men went off to war. 100,000 or so also went to the war as soldiers. The Japanese government was not confident that Koreans would be able to function as good, loyal Japanese soldiers early on. They were allowed to volunteer for the army in 1938, but were only conscripted, only drafted into the Japanese Imperial Army toward the end of the war. And perhaps now the most notorious aspect of the Japanese wartime mobilization in Korea was the sending of so-called comfort women, who numbered, we think now, estimates vary, but perhaps 200,000, of whom the vast majority were Koreans, to the various fronts of the war to take care of the Japanese soldiers. And the comfort women, as you may know, were not prostitutes, because that would be too elevated a term. They were the term that's now used is military sex slaves, military sexual slavery, MSS, is the term that people now are using for this system of sending young women and girls. Some seem to have been as young as 12 or 13 to sexually service the Japanese military. So if there is a reason that the Japanese occupation is remembered with such bitterness, a lot of it has to do with this period. I mean, the whole Japanese occupation certainly had its difficulties, but the worst part was this 9 years or so of war. It is, of course, true that the Japanese themselves were exploited and suffered a great deal during the war, but after all, it was their country they were fighting for, but the Koreans were forced into this by another country. The war did end, as we know, with the Japanese defeat in August of 1945, which is celebrated as Liberation Day in Korea today. But it did not result in Korean independence exactly. Toward the end of the war, the United States and the Soviet Union had discussed what to do with the territory vacated by the end of the Japanese Empire, which would have to be dissolved, they've agreed, once Japan was defeated. The Japanese defeat appeared to be imminent after the atomic bombing of Hiroshima on August 6th and Nagasaki on August 9th. But this meant that the Russians could very quickly move in into the territory vacated by the Japanese, because the Russians were there on the border with Korea. The Americans were only in Okinawa at that time. So the Russians entered the war against Japan on August 8th. On August 10th, the State War Naval Coordinating Committee, which was formulating high-level policy about post-war order, met to discuss what to do about the Japanese Empire and about Korea specifically. So the decision was made looking at a National Geographic map of Korea, which did not have a lot of topographic markers and so forth, that Korea would have to be, would best be divided into spheres of influence. And somehow the Americans should have the southern part, and the Soviets could take the northern half, because the Soviets had expected that they would also have part of Japan as their zone of occupation. But it turned out the U.S. did not give them part of Japan, that the occupation of Japan would be essentially be a unilateral occupation by the U.S. For whatever reason, however, the Soviets agreed, and they stopped their troops at the 38th parallel, 38 degrees north. And the Americans came in a couple of weeks later and moved their troops up from the south to the 30th parallel. Here's American troops entering Seoul. You see, that's the government general building with the American flag flying in front of it. That building was had several uses after the war. It originally billeted American troops. Then it was used by the independent government of South Korea. Then it became a museum. And finally, in 1995, the government of South Korea decided to destroy this building because it was too much of a reminder of the Japanese occupation. And they very dramatically blew it up after taking off the cupola on top. So there's now an unobstructed view. You can see the palace from the street, and the energies coming from the president's mansion can flow unobstructed down to the people, although it doesn't seem to be working very well for this president. But the Soviets and Americans could not agree on what form a post-Japanese occupation Korean government would be. There was no obvious leader that could run Korea. There was no obvious type of government. There were people from all over the political spectrum, from communists who were rather well organized and had a very significant structure of members, to quite right-wing people. But perhaps the most well-known leader in exile, and most of the Koreans who fancied themselves to be political leaders were in exile, because if you stayed behind in Korea and had any notions of independence, you would be in jail or dead. Perhaps the most well-known person was Lee Sung-man, or Sigmund Rhee, as he was called to most Americans, who had spent much of the colonial period in Hawaii, and also in Washington, D.C., and lobbied for American support. You might call him the Ahmed Chalabi of Korea, except unlike Chalabi, the U.S. continued to back him after he came back. He was a bit of a tough customer. This is General Hodge on his right, who didn't like him at all. But he had the name. He had his network of supporters. And by 1947, the U.S. decided that he would be their man in Korea. Unfortunately, the Russians had other ideas, and the Russians were going about building their own support base in the north, which was largely dominated by communists. And in the meantime, the communists were blamed for uprisings and unrest in the south, and then eventually the communists were outlawed in the south. So you had, by as early as the beginning of 1946, two different governments emerging, one in Seoul under the American occupation, one in Pyongyang under the Soviet occupation. The most prominent figure in the north, in Pyongyang, was this fellow here, Cho Man-sik, who was nationalist leader in the 1920s, rather conservative fellow, a Presbyterian elder. The main center of Protestant Christianity — I talked earlier about Catholic Christianity, but the main center of Protestant Christianity in Korea before 1945 was Pyongyang. Pyongyang was called by Presbyterian missionaries the Jerusalem of the East. From 1907, when there was this apparently enormous revival uprising, in which thousands were converted to Christianity, up until the 1940s, Protestantism really took hold in the north of Korea. This is one of the Soviet generals in the occupation force in the middle, and then to his right, eating with his chopsticks, is Kim Il-sung. Kim Il-sung was a young guerrilla fighter who had spent most of his life from an early age in northeast China, in Manchuria, although he was a native of just outside of Pyongyang. And he had joined the Chinese Communist Party in the mid-1930s and was part of a joint Chinese-Korean guerrilla force which harassed the Japanese. They didn't have a lot of success. The Japanese occupation, or rather the Japanese counterinsurgency effort in Manchuria was quite brutal and effective by the end of the 1930s. And in 1940, Kim went into exile with a group of other members of his force into Russia near Khabarovsk, where he remained until he came with the Soviet army in October of 1945. Cho, although the most popular native leader in the north, didn't get along too well with the Soviets. Soviets put him under house arrest in January of 1946, and he disappeared in the early stages of the war. Meanwhile, Kim was working his way up in the Northern Korean Communist Party ranks, and he was more or less the Soviet man in the North by the middle of 1946. So once again, you had two governments, two leaders under two occupations by the 1940s, and they could not reach an agreement. There were two meetings between the Soviets and Americans, one in Moscow, one in Seoul, on how to form some kind of a coalition government. This did not reach a definite conclusion. Finally, in 1947, the U.S. turned the whole issue over to the United Nations, which had only recently been formed. The United Nations sent an observer mission to oversee an election in Korea. The Soviets and the North Koreans refused to allow the U.N. observers into North Korea, observers observed an election which was held only in the south, and Syngman Rhee was elected president. But of course, Rhee argued that he was president over all of Korea, not just South Korea. Meanwhile, a few weeks later, the North Koreans had their own election on September 9th, 1948, and Kim Il-sung, not surprisingly, was elected the premier. And that, too, was a government supposedly over all of Korea. Therefore, you had two governments. There he is, handsome young man, 33 years old at the time of Korea's liberation. This is a North Korean photo. They've cropped out all the Soviet officers who are standing right behind him. Well, the result that should have surprised no one, and certainly didn't surprise anyone who was on the ground in 1948, was war, civil war between the North and the South. There was already considerable border fighting in the summer of 1949 after the Soviets withdrew their troops from the north and the Americans were withdrawing their forces from the south. But in early 1950, the situation changed. Kim Il-sung lobbied very hard with the Soviets to get their support for an attack on South Korea. He argued that the Americans really weren't that interested in protecting South Korea, that the South Korean government was weak, the South Korean military was not up to the defense of their country yet, but it could be given time. A large group of ethnic Korean soldiers who were veterans of the Civil War in China came back from China at that time. But when Kim first asked this in 1949, Stalin refused. He went to Moscow and asked Stalin directly about military support for an attack on South Korea, but Stalin did not want to provoke the Americans. The last thing Stalin wanted was World War III over Korea. He was having enough difficulty in Europe with the U.S. But eventually, in early 1950, Stalin changed his mind and decided that Kim's plan might just work, that the U.S. wouldn't come to the defense of South Korea, and that this would be a relatively easy victory for the communist side. The final go-ahead was given on June 22nd of 1950, and on June 25th, 1950, the North Korean army invaded South Korea. And indeed, it seemed that Kim's plan was going to work. that the South Korean army wouldn't put up much of a defense, the Americans wouldn't come in, and all of South Korea would be taken over by the North. Things didn't quite work out that way in the end. The U.S. did support South Korea, as we all know. The Northern Korean forces were pushed back. And then the Chinese entered the war in the fall of 1950, pushed the U.N. forces back. The U.N. was officially in charge of the effort against North Korea, although overwhelmingly the U.N. force was dominated by the U.S., and the head of the U.N. command was General Douglas MacArthur, the head of the Supreme Commander of Allied Forces in the Pacific. So by the summer of 1951, the war was a stalemate between the U.S., U.N., ROK forces on the one side, and the Chinese and the North Korean forces on the other. The Soviets were willing to support the North Koreans to the last Chinese, you might say. In other words, the Russians were not about to send their own troops into Korea. For 2 years, there was a bloody slaughter along the middle of the country, which accomplished very little but killed many people, including perhaps as many as 3 million Koreans, not to mention 500,000 Chinese, 35,000 Americans, and a couple of hundred Koreans on both sides. On July 27th, 1953, they decided to institutionalize the stalemate and declare an armistice. There would be a temporary end to the fighting, not a peace treaty, but the fighting would stop, and they would go to political negotiations to reach a settlement. The hope was that within a year, you would have a political settlement which would unify Korea. Well, that still hasn't happened, almost 60 years later. What happened instead was a permanent division of Korea, and immediately after the war, the rebuilding of an extraordinarily devastated country. To understand what Korea was like in 1953, you'd have to go to a place like Afghanistan today, which was, in terms of its level of poverty and condition of infrastructure, rather similar to what Korea was in 1953, right after the war. People in Pyongyang rebuilding by hand after the war in North Korea. That's what Pyongyang looks today. Very modern city, a kind of showcase capital for the outside world, and not typical of the way most North Koreans live. But still, until the economy got really bad in the 1990s, a rather impressive display of post-war reconstruction and industrialization. This is not a very good picture, unfortunately, but this is what Seoul looked like in 1953. You can see the government general building back there. And basically, the city is a pile of rubble. It was taken and retaken four times in the war and bombed by the U.S. And the site of street-to-street fighting for both the U.S. and the Chinese at least twice. And Seoul today, again, an extraordinary, impressive achievement of post-war reconstruction. However, although both sides did recover from the devastation of the war, and South Korea is, as I mentioned at the beginning, one of the most important economies of the world, the issue which brought about the war in the first place, the division of the country, still hasn't been resolved, and Korea remains divided to this day. I'm going to stop here. I have one more shorter PowerPoint, let's see. Okay, about the Korean diaspora. But I want to take some questions or comments first. Yes?
Early in 1950,
mm-hmm.
Dean Acheson, I think that's Trump's Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking to reporters.
Right.
He was talking about a sphere of influence.
Right.
That there was this fear we would protect these countries against communism at all costs.
Right.
And he's mentioned the Philippines, Southeast Asia, and he conspicuously left out Korea.
Right. It was at the National Press Club in Washington in January 1950, and Acheson, the Secretary of State, made a speech. And there's some controversy about how important that speech was, and, you know, whether Stalin really took seriously what was not said in the speech. And basically, you're right. He said, we will defend this as our sphere of influence, essentially a line of islands from Japan through the Philippines down through Southeast Asia, and left out South Korea. And many people have said that this gave the communists, you know, a green light to attack South Korea. But it's not entirely clear that they really believe that. There's some evidence that Kim Il-sung did think that was the case. And perhaps Stalin did too. But some people also argue that Stalin knew very well that the U.S. would likely to defend South Korea, and that this would be a way of bogging down the Chinese and keeping the Chinese and the Americans fighting each other and the Russians above the fray. But yeah, Acheson has been blamed ever since for not including Korea in that speech. Anyone else? Yes. Well, immediately after the war, until 1947, the border was completely open. And mostly that meant people coming from the north and from Manchuria into the south, because for many centuries, the south was more populous than the north. It says better climate, you know, you can grow rice better and so forth. But under the Japanese, there was a big effort to build industry in the north. So a lot of Koreans moved to the industrial centers built at that time in the 1920s and 1930s. And then once Manchuria was taken by the Japanese, a lot of Koreans moved into Manchuria too. So with the end of World War II, everyone was basically moving back to where they came from. So it was a huge migration of Koreans from Manchuria and northern Korea down to the south. Then in 1946, with land reform and other social reforms and the political takeover of the north by the communists, there were a lot of northerners who fled that regime to go into the south. There were some that went from the south to the north, but there were a lot fewer of those. Around 1947, the Soviets began to close the border more, so it became more difficult, but not impossible. And then when the war broke out, of course, there were massive refugee flows from the north to the south. But with the armistice in 1953, that border became completely closed. And now the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, which runs across the line of armistice, the ceasefire line, which is why it's an irregular line. It's not the 30th parallel. Whenever I have my exams, and if the student says Korea today is divided at the 30th parallel, I mark that answer wrong. Korea is not divided at the 30th parallel. It's divided at the demilitarized zone, or the military demarcation line, which is more or less along the 30th parallel, but it is not the 30th parallel. The 30th parallel is what initially divided Korea in 1945. The DMZ is probably now the most impervious border in the world. I mean, it's just impossible to go across it. You certainly risk your life to do so. It's heavily mined. It's got heavily armed border guards, fences, and so on. And which makes Korea different from any other divided country. I mean, Germans were going back and forth for decades before the fall of the Berlin Wall. But you can't do that in Korea. Except for now, southern tourists and businessmen can go to the north, and many are doing that. But your movement is extremely limited. Basically, if you're a tourist going to North Korea, you can go to one of the two tourist areas, and that's it. If you're a businessman, you're confined to wherever your business is, usually in Kaesong, industrial zone in the south. And so what that means, in effect, is the extreme isolation of North Korea. Because, of course, South Koreans can go wherever they want, but North Koreans really can't travel to the south and have very little contact with people from the outside. Yes.
Mm-hmm. What would be the circumstances that family would have been separated at that time? Would they not have all left together?
Yes. Well, many families couldn't leave together for whatever reason. Many families simply lived apart before the demarcation, and then they couldn't meet again after the country was divided. Of course, there are fewer and fewer people who actually have memories, who actually were alive before 1953, so they don't remember a unified Korea. But the family reunions, which began in 1985, on and off, now there are quite a few more than there used to be, are controlled by the two governments, and only select people can meet each other and the families. Unlike in the case of Germany, where basically anybody from West Germany could go and visit their relatives in the East, and they could invite their relatives in the East to come to the West. That's not the case at all in Korea. Yes. Yeah, they all changed them back, of course. Right, right. Yes. Yeah, it's got some animals and plants that you can't find anywhere else in Korea anymore. So there's some talk of turning it into a big environmental park. I don't think that'll happen, but it's a nice idea. Yes, you had a question?
We understand that the division is externally imposed on Korea. What was the popular support? Would the people have support after
the... Well, that's a real... question. It was quite confusing. No one supported the Japanese, obviously, and many people who had worked closely with the Japanese were disgraced and imprisoned, and certainly fell from grace. The communists were very well organized, and they had a lot of support in some parts of the country. There were different political parties which had different kinds of support. There was an attempt before the U.S. started the occupation to create a broad coalition government in Seoul that would include, interestingly enough, this government, which never really took off, called the Korean People's Republic, which was established in early September of 1945, had a roster of leaders which included both Syngman Rhee and Kim Il-sung, neither of whom was actually in Korea at the time, so we don't know what would happen if they had joined this government. But in the end, the U.S. occupation came in under Hodge and outlawed any native Korean political organization. It was the very first thing he said when he came into Korea was that the U.S. military is the only government of Korea. So any government organized by Koreans had to be abolished. So that made some people very unhappy, and so they basically had to rebuild again. So yeah, different people supported different groups. I think it's fair to say one thing, however, which was that no one in Korea wanted a divided nation. Of all the countries divided after World War II, I think Korea was the most unfairly divided. Had nothing to do with real divisions, geographical or political. It had entirely to do with the two occupations and the people that they worked with. Okay, let me go quickly through my last topic today, which is on getting us outside of the peninsula onto the diaspora. This is a shipload of Koreans going back from Japan to Korea in 1945. As I said, something like 2 million Koreans were in Japan at that time. Most of them wanted to go back. 60% or so of them did, but others stayed behind for a variety of reasons, not least because there was often nothing to go back to in Korea in terms of jobs or even their homes after years in Japan. At the end of World War II, there were 4 million Koreans in China, Japan, and the Soviet Union. Now, depending on how you estimate it, 5 to 7 million Koreans. abroad. So there's two things about the diaspora that are important to keep in mind. One is the newness of it. It really didn't exist before the 1860s. And second, the proportional size. 7 million out of 70 million, 10%, is fairly significant. You can see that the largest number now, according to the Overseas Korean Foundation in Seoul, is in the U.S. That's very recent. For most of the period since 1945, the largest community was in China, right across the border from North Korea. Then Japan, and then the former USSR, by which we mean mostly the states of Central Asia, particularly Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. I'll talk in a moment of how the Koreans got there, and some in Russia as well. This is actually, I don't want to go into all of this. Let's skip ahead here. Let's go, the Hawaiian, the American case begins in Hawaii. The first group of plantation laborers came to Hawaii, which was then, of course, not a state, but a territory of the United States in 1903, followed by picture brides, women who came. The first laborers were, of course, men, and then brides-to-be came later, who are identified by their photograph. And then this immigration was stopped in 1924, and therefore almost no immigration until the Korean War. But a number of Koreans in the United States were associated with the Korean independence movement. An Chang-ho, who was a very prominent liberation fighter, and then Syngman Rhee. As I mentioned, returned exiles founded both governments of South and North Korea, Syngman Rhee from the United States, Kim Il-sung from China and Russia, and they continued to have immigrant communities with close contact in those countries, North Korea to Korean Chinese, South Korea to Korean Americans. Japan is a special case. Japan is quite unusual for a number of reasons. One is that it's the only country in which ethnic Koreans don't do very well in this society. Koreans in Japan are kind of a marginalized ethnic group. They're the only significant ethnic minority in Japan, and they tend to be identified with rather unsavory occupations like organized crime and gambling parlors. Although not all of them do that, of course, but that's how they're often perceived in Japan. And Japan, being itself a kind of mono-ethnic society, has a great deal of difficulty absorbing these ethnic Koreans into the mainstream society. But what's particularly odd about Japan is that even though most of the ethnic Koreans in Japan came from the southern part of Korea, from 1959 to the early 80s, almost 100,000 ethnic Koreans migrated voluntarily to North Korea, because they were invited to do so by the North Korean government and because they felt that their opportunities in the North were better than in the South. They faced a great deal of discrimination, but there has been a shift toward integration since the 1980s. Zainichi, or residence in Japan, is the way that most of these Koreans are referred to. And there has been, until recent times, until the 1990s, a very sharp division politically between pro-North and pro-South Koreans. It's not the case in any other place where there's a large Korean minority. There tends to be either mostly one or the other. The Chosonjok, which was what the Chinese term, or the Korean pronunciation of the Chinese term for the Koreans in China, have their own autonomous area, the Korean Nationality Autonomous Prefecture. As you may know, various minorities in China have autonomous regions, Tibetans, Mongols, Muslims, and so forth. And Koreans have theirs as well, in part in Jilin Province. They have been close to North Korea. They've sometimes suffered from the political shifts in the North and have been attacked as rightists or enemies of the state in the 50s and in the Cultural Revolution in the 60s. But there's been a significant migration to South Korea since the mid-1980s when South Korea and China first established relations. And now ethnic Koreans from China are the largest minority, if we want to call them that, in South Korea. Many of them there illegally. The Koryo Sarum, you remember, Koryo is an older word for Korea. That's the word that the Russian Koreans or the Koreans of the former Soviet Union used for themselves. They've been relatively isolated from Korea. Most remain in Central Asia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. How did they get there? Well, in the 1910s and 20s, there was a very large community of ethnic Koreans in the Russian Far East. Not surprisingly, that's where they went, across the border into Russia. There were perhaps 200,000 or so Koreans in the Russian Far East at that time. But after the Japanese takeover of Manchuria in 1932, tensions between Japan and the Soviet Union became more pronounced, and the Soviet government was concerned about Japanese influence along their border. In 1937, Stalin or somebody had the bright idea that these ethnic Koreans might be agents for Japan and a threat to the Russian presence there. So the whole group, the 200,000 Koreans, oh, not quite all of them, but most of them, were put on train cars and sent as far away from the Russian Far East as they could get in the Soviet Union, and that was Central Asia. They were deposited 4,000 miles, not a very pleasant train ride, as you can imagine, and left in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, where they remain today. On the island of Sakhalin, which you may remember, the southern half of Sakhalin was incorporated into the Japanese Empire in 1905. Several thousand Koreans were sent there to work in the coal mines during the colonial period. When World War II ended, unlike the Japanese, these Koreans were not sent back. The World War II allies had a policy of repatriating Japanese back to Japan. But since suddenly in 1945 the Koreans were not Japanese anymore, they had been Japanese until then, but now they weren't Japanese, the Allies had no obligation to send them back to Korea. So they were stranded there until the early 1990s when they finally were taken back through treaty between Russia and Korea, South Korea. Korean Americans also came in various waves of migration. Originally, we had talked before about the plantation workers, then later students, adopted Korean Americans, and so-called GI brides, or the Korean wives of American servicemen. But there were no large, really, groups of Korean Americans coming until 1965 with the new immigration law, which allowed a large, much larger quota of immigrants from Latin America and Asia. By the late 80s, Koreans had become the third largest immigrant group to the U.S. after Mexicans and Filipinos, and have tended to be disproportionately, compared to other immigrants and compared to Korean migrants elsewhere, urban, middle class, educated, and Christian. About 80% of Korean Americans are Christian, whereas in Korea itself, in South Korea, only about 25% are Christian. Foreign adoption, and this is the last bit I'll talk about here, is sort of a separate case of the Korean diaspora, almost entirely after the Korean War, primarily from South Korea, although there were some North Korean children adopted by Eastern Europeans during the war, but they all apparently went back in the early 1960s. The largest number went to the USA. In fact, an American started the program, Henry Holt, who was an Oregon farmer, and was particularly concerned with the mixed kids, so-called Amerasian children, who had been left behind by the American GI fathers. And in 1956, Holt lobbied Congress to organize what was called Operation Baby Lift, which brought 300 Amerasian children from South Korea to give to American military families in Japan. And a disproportionate large number of adoptees. I don't know what the ranking is now. Until not long ago, South Korea was among the top three countries as a source of adopted children for the U.S. And all the other countries that it could be compared to were much, much poorer. So it is a little odd. And here are the... I have two numbers for the U.S., but anyway, the U.S. is by far the largest... by far the largest number of adopted Koreans, followed, interestingly enough, by France is number two, then Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Netherlands, and so forth.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Korea Society. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for more information about memberships and to learn more about the programs available at the Korea Society.